This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears. I'm joined, as always, by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we've got one sponsor for the show, which is Jamf Software, our friends at Jamf, makers of the Casper Suite, MDM management tool for Macs and iOS devices. We'll tell you some more about them as the show goes on. Evening, Bradley. How are you?
Fantastic. How about yourself?
It's been a bit exciting just getting the show up and running today. I upgraded to Mavericks, and that has been a little more destabilizing than I had thought on my recording system. But I think we're up and running now. We're trying some new technology today, so we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, I guess that's the life you live when you're on the bleeding edge.
I guess it is, yeah. And when you don't test as much as you probably should.
The only issue I'm having with it is mail is a little wonky for me. But other than that, it seems fine. But it's funny, I'm having the same issues with it that I had in Mountain Lion, like the initial releases. It's a real weird issue where my iCloud mail always starts offline, and I have to take it online manually every single time.
That's weird.
Yeah, it's very strange, and it happened up until about 10.2 in Mountain Lion, and then it just fixed itself one day.
Nice. I always like it when things that just have some kind of unexplained, surprising fix that otherwise shouldn't have happened.
Exactly. And so I don't know. Who knows what it is? But it's not like...
It just fills you with confidence.
Well, it's not even a big enough problem for me to spend like 30 minutes trying to fix it, because it takes me literally 1 second every time I open mail, which is once a day.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Do you just love software?
Yes. You know.
I don't know about you, but I can feel like things are getting less reliable rather than more. I don't know what the deal is with that, but I just feel like... Every time I pick up a piece of software, something's broken about it now.
Well,
it's really annoying me just now.
I think that in some ways is because of our pursuit of innovation. You know, like, I always like joke that Snow Leopard 10.6.8 was the most stable operating system I ever used. And you could still be using that today, largely. But we have this continued drive towards new and better, and it's hard to do... New, better, and more stable. Like, it's hard to do all of those. You know, you can do like, you can pick two of those, you can't pick all three.
Yeah, the whole move fast and break things ethos is not exactly conducive to getting your job done every day.
No, and it's been interesting. I picked up the new book by Brad Stone on Jeff Bezos and Amazon.com, and I'll have a link for that in the show notes. I picked up the Audible version, actually. It's been really interesting to hear about the early days of Amazon and just and really some of like the bootstrap things that they did to get their website up and running, and how, you know, it was just like they had a Unix command that they could kind of continually pull to check their total sales, and it was so taxing on the server that they'd turn it off. And, you know, you think about that now with the kind of infrastructure that Amazon runs, and it's kind of laughable, but I'm about a third of the way through the book and really enjoying it. It's just funny to hear kind of like some of those early stories from Amazon.
Yeah, that's real startup life, isn't it?
Yeah, it's funny. The more I listen, you know, I think we all kind of have a like a drive to kind of be a part of that maybe. And I think that would be fun. But then you hear those stories about working like, you know, 22 hours a day and sleeping for 2 hours for weeks on end. I think to myself, I don't know that that's worth it on any level. And so I lean more towards the 37 signals of like kind of slow, predictable, sustainable growth for a business where your employee, like I would like to think that if I was running a startup, like I would tell my employees, like, you need to go home and be with your family because I care about you more as a person than just making another dollar or getting a new version out, you know, 3 days earlier. And I like to think that I would be that way.
Yeah, I mean, so at some level, that's it's fine when you're 21 and you're giving your whole life to build something. But, you know, eventually you get to a stage where you do want to go home at a reasonable time and see your kids and actually have a holiday occasionally as well. So it goes. Anyway, shall we dig into it tonight, Bradley?
Yeah, let's get to it.
I think we should probably give people warning tonight. I think what we're about to do is kind of a little bit outside the scope of what we normally do on the show, and it may or may not work well. It may be bizarre and a little bit strange, or it may be great. I'm not totally sure which is which, so fair warning, if you want to skip some of this, that might work. But basically, where this came from, Bradley, is that I've been reading a book by a guy called Adam Greenfield, who some people might have heard of, but he's not really in our field. He's essentially a kind of urban informatics theorist, if you like, and by that I mean he's interested in the implications of computers, sensors, and network systems for cities, basically. And I first heard of him, I don't know if you've encountered him before this conversation, Bradley, but I first heard him speak a number of years ago at a conference called Deconstruct in the UK, which is a kind of, it's like a smarter, more technical version of TED, perhaps, which has a theme every year, and it's different every year, but it can be pretty interesting from time to time. And I heard him speak a number of years ago, and I've kind of followed his work ever since. And one of the things he's been working on is he's been working on a book called, that's putatively titled, The City Is Here For You To Use. And he's been working on it for quite a long time now, but what he's done is he's produced he calls it a pamphlet, but it's essentially a Kindle single. It's available in various forms, but it's available through Kindle singles, called Against the Smart City. And what it is a collection of short sections or chapters from what will eventually become this book. And what he's talking about is he's essentially produced a treatise against the idea of highly networked, high-tech cities. And as I was reading this, I thought that the analogy between what he was writing about smart cities and what I've been thinking about the smart classroom idea and the whole idea of learning management systems and tablets that are built into those systems, I found his ideas and his critique of the city and almost gave voice to what I thought about the smart classroom. And what I wanted to do tonight was just kind of talk through some of the sections of his pamphlet and try and draw analogies to the smart classroom and see if his criticisms actually worked well against some of my concerns about systems that are a bit like that. Does that sound like something we could make work?
I think so. Before we get rolling, let's take a moment to thank our sponsor for tonight. It's Jamp Software. They provide ICT staff with enterprise tools that manage the widespread use of Apple technologies such as Macs, iPads, iPhones, and Apple TVs in educational organizations. Now, the cool thing I love about Jamp is they are Apple-focused, so they don't treat Apple products as second tier. You know, they get updates later. Apple is their focus, and I think that's one of the reasons that a lot of schools really love Jamp, because they know that Apple is treated as a first-class citizen. And now with Casper Focus, they have placed these powerful technologies directly into the hands of the teachers that work with students every day. Casper Focus allows teachers to quickly gain students' attention, conduct secure exams within an app. They can select an Apple TV assigned to their class and choose and distribute iBooks, and even initiate AirPlay right within Casper Focus. So again, Casper Focus is one of the things that comes with the Casper Suite. You can learn more at jampsoftware.com.
Okay. So, essentially, this book, Bradley, I know you've been reading it a little bit as well. I'm not sure how far through it you are, but it comes in about 13 different sections. And I wanted to at least read them all out tonight, and perhaps some of them will be more pertinent than others. But I think where I'm coming from with this is I look at systems like the Amplify tablet that people are talking about in the US and various other kind of, let's say, vertically integrated technology systems where you have some kind of network software as part of the system and some kind of computer that the children use either exclusively or in a shared situation. But what we're talking about here is some kind of computer system that is supposed to manage, collect data, or run some part of the classroom. And I think this comes under different names. It comes under names like learning management system. It comes under names like smart classroom, sometimes it's called. Other times it's just called, it's given a proprietary name. Sometimes a MOOC is one of the terms that's used, although that can sometimes mean something a little different as well. But what Greenfield talks about in his book in terms of a smart city is he uses three specific examples. He talks about Plan IT Valley in Portugal. He talks about Madsar City in the Middle East. And he talks about the city of New Songdo in South Korea. And all three of these cities are based on a conception of the idea that the citizen will have a networked experience of the city so that sensors are everywhere and they optimize parts of the city, and they help traffic flow, and they can manage waste, and they can manage air quality and different things, and monitor pedestrian movements and so on. And when Greenfield writes, he's essentially critiquing these ideas as being very inapposite to what a city really is and what a city should be and what really makes the best of a city. And what I wanted to do was try and connect those 13 ideas along with some ideas that you see in the smart classroom literature and try and see if the critique matches up. So the first thing that he talks about, and when I should say that what I mean by the classroom examples, one thing that I'm particularly thinking of is this Amplify tablet, and I've got a number of examples here that I want to try and connect the kind of language that's used about the Amplify tablet with the critique that Greenfield makes in his book. So the first thing that Greenfield says, the first two chapters, he says the smart city is built in generic space and the smart city unfolds in generic time. I want to read a couple of paragraphs from this section. He says, quote, out of all the potentials that our moment might give rise to, and all the modes in which we might choose to use networked information technology in our cities, the narrative of the smart city, as it is currently being articulated and advanced to us, represents some of the least interesting and the most problematic, end quote. And I think what's interesting about that is that in some ways, I don't know if you feel the same way about this, Bradley, but I feel in some ways the conceptions of what we can do with technology in the classroom right now are actually potentially problematic, but certainly not as interesting as they could be. And I think we'll maybe mention a little bit more of that as we go on with this. The second quote I wanted to read to you was he talks about how when people write about the smart city, they tell stories about what life might be like in that city. And he says, quote, in the just-so stories we're told about the smart city, the technology of everyday life advances, but everything else somehow magically remains the same. From family size and structure, to work arrangements, to the conception of the self, everything proceeds as though sequestered, serenely untouched by the radical discontinuity in the technics of the daily, end quote. Can you see where I'm going with this, Bradley?
I think so.
Yeah. So what I kind of mean to point out with this is that if you look at something like the Amplify tablet project, for example, which is obviously a major corporate project, it seems to me that what they're kind of offering is the idea that you can bring in a radical increase in the amount of technology in the classroom, but actually keep learning and teaching essentially pretty much the same. Do you know what I mean by that?
Elaborate for me.
So the idea that when you say you bring a tablet into the classroom and you give every child a tablet, what a lot of these systems purport to do is that you will still have reading, writing, arithmetic, science, literature. You'll have all the same topics in the curriculum, and you'll still have the same kind of amount of time in the day, and the school day won't particularly change, and what you do in the classroom won't particularly change, but it will just be that everybody's got a tablet. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
There's no vision to really change what does school look like, or how does the teacher interact with the students, when does the teacher interact with the students, anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's essentially like you could basically say the same thing, that we believe that putting a fireplace in every classroom will help things, but we don't really know how. You could pick any object and you add it to the classroom. You don't change anything. Or you could say, okay, we want to make the rooms warmer, so we're going to put a fireplace in there, but not turn them on.
Yeah, it's kind of like that. And I kind of feel like if we're going to tell stories about a tablet-enabled classroom future, is the best we can do to say that we'll just monitor how everybody reads the book? Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, could we possibly not have a book? Could the book do something completely different? But instead, the conceptions are very, very stilted and staid. And I think that's partly what Greenfield is kind of critiquing here, is that of all the things that you could do with technology in the city, and I'm seeing in the classroom, is that the best we can think of? And I think the thing that kind of gives it away to me is at the end of the second chapter, he's talking about two researchers called Genevieve Bell and Paul Dewish, who write... they wrote a book called situated action. It's called Where the Action Is. And he says that Bell and Dourish suggests another possibility, that when the smart city does emerge, it will do so in a form that we're unprepared for and unable to recognise as such. And I think that's really telling, is that when, in some ways, Bradley, like, the smart classroom's already here. Like, people are doing things on computers, networked together, but we can't recognise it as such because it's not in one database. Does that make sense? Like, kids have already got these computers, you know?
Well, and it's not a program. It's not a turnkey system that you buy that you say, this is the smart classroom package, and we're going to buy this and implement the smart classroom, and then, you know, you walk into the classroom and it's got, you know, smart classroom ink, wallpaper, cameras, TVs, you know, name badges. It's not the technology. You know, what I think I've heard it quoted a lot recently from Ernest Hemingway, that you go bankrupt slowly and then quickly. And technology is really that way. Like, it moves slowly and then quickly. And I think the kind of that turn point is it moves so quickly and we don't even notice it. And it just, you know, just like we had a student, we had an example here recently. Student was going out of town and left her book at school. So she emailed her teacher and said, hey, will you take a picture of our math homework inside the book and email it back to me? And again, there's no program. I mean, and that's a small example, but it's like, you're right. Mm-hmm. The kid, I mean, these are fifth graders. This is not even thinking what are high school students doing. These are fifth graders that are figuring this stuff out, and it's just happening. And it's not a program. And I think that scares a lot of people who make a living by selling things to schools, because it's not something they can put their finger on to put in a box.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting to kind of relate that back to cities as well, is if you think about many of the biggest cities on the planet, many of them are broadly informal. You look at places like Mumbai or Rio or many of these large cities, there's a formal part, but there's a massive informal part. And to me, some of that kind of idea, like, I've seen kids do things with iPads in schools that I've visited where, you know, because they can't download something from BBC iPlayer, but what they're doing is they're holding their iPad up to the TV and recording it on their iPad, which is incredibly low-tech, almost favela-like, slum type of way to do technology. But people are putting these things together. They're just combining things that they find lying about. And I think in some ways that this a smart classroom is emerging, but it's not as a package sold by a technology vendor. And I think that's particularly interesting. It's certainly something to keep an eye on.
Well, and we put the tool. Our goal should be to, you know, just as a city's goal should be to put the tools in place and create the environment that allows a city to thrive naturally. We should be creating environments that allow students to come up with those solutions. You know, we should not try to force, you know, this single path forward. You know, you must do it this way, and this is how you'll learn. Let students learn. You know, just create an environment that allows them to learn.
Yeah, and particularly when we pay such lip service to wanting creativity in school, but yet we sort of want creativity in a very structured fashion at a certain time, and at no other time should there be any creativity except at the time that we decide we're having creativity time, then I think it's interesting to kind of track that as a, you know, how do these things break out in ways that we don't expect them to? And that's an interesting thing to keep an eye on. Next chapter I wanted to look at, Bradley, was the third chapter, which is entitled The Smart City Positions Technology Itself as Generic. And I think this is very interesting from a point of view of looking at the way that tablets are being used, but more often than used, actually talked about in schools, where people talk about, you know, we're using tablets in our school. We're using tablets. We've got 7 inches of tablet in everybody's hands or whatever. And I think, well, I want to read a quote from this chapter, but I think it's very, very telling in terms of the idea that not all technology is the same. And schools too often, I think, talk about using technology as if any technology is equivalent to any other technology. And I had a conversation on Twitter just this morning with a few people who were saying that, is there really just one tablet market? Are tablets being used for the same things all over? Or is there a real meaningful difference to the way that some people are using certain kinds of tablet versus certain other kinds of tablet. And that's probably another whole show in itself once I kind of think it through a little bit more. But let me read you this couple of paragraphs from the book here. He says, quote, low-level network hardware can probably be treated abstractly without doing them too much violence, which is why they're thought of, referred to, priced and valued as the commodities they are. But the higher up the stack you go, the closer to the end user you get, the more the differences in the provenance and design of the systems involved matter. He says, what do exist in the world are specific deployments of components from specific vendors, laminated together as particular propositions, and each of these may differ profoundly from other similar propositions along all of the axes that condition human interaction with them. It's all but impossible to fairly evaluate claims about the performance of systems like these without knowing just what it is that's being suggested. Information technological components may certainly be modular and interoperable, in other words, but the systems built from them are not at all fungible. That is, they're not at all replaceable with one another. End quote. So I think what's interesting about that to me, Bradley, is that when people talk about having a tablet deployment, and you say, well, we had this result with our tablet deployment, and we had this result with our tablet deployment, why are they not the same thing? I think this right here strikes exactly to the heart of that question, which is that it's not just the fact that you've got a tablet and I've got a tablet, and therefore our results are comparable, but it's our tablet plus our Wi-Fi infrastructure plus our school MIS system plus our email system plus, you know, the bandwidth we have to the internet, plus policy, plus the way we use it on top, that whole stack of technologies can be radically different, even amongst two schools who both have, let's say, one-to-one iPad deployments. Have you seen that?
Oh, absolutely. Well, and a lot of it even goes down to just the culture of the staff and the buy-in of the staff. Mm. I mean, I can put, you know, three-year-old technology into a hand of a teacher who loves it and is going to use it to, you know, create environments to allow students to learn and to engage your students. And then you can put something that's hot off the shelf, the latest and greatest, into a teacher who is indifferent, and you'll see you can guess the results. It just comes. The more schools I've seen, the more I've talked to, the ones that are the most successful are the ones whose culture among the teachers and the staff lend itself to this kind of evolution.
Yeah, I think that really gets to the heart of it. And the last paragraph that I'd highlighted to and just mentioned from this chapter is, he says, reasons like these are precisely why the canonical smart city almost has to be staged in any space, whatever. That, what he means by that is like generic space without reference to a specific location. He says, only by proposing to install generic technologies on generic landscapes in a generic future can advocates avoid running afoul of the knotty complexities that crop up immediately anytime actual technologies are deployed in existing places. And I think that gets to the heart of what we're trying to talk about in this show, Bradley, is that it's not just about buying an iPad and putting it into everybody's hands, that it's not just about having a really robust Wi-Fi system and then great things are going to happen, but rather you have to think about the fact that this is a technologically empowered culture change for your school. And you're absolutely right that the schools that provide the cultural and organizational context to do the right thing with technology can do that regardless of the actual technology that's in their hands. So when people say it's not about the technology, they are in part right, but they're also in part wrong, because if it's not about the technology, then it is actually the entire stack. That's an assertion that the entire stack of technology could be replaced with any other stack of technology and you would get the same result. And that's not true either. But at the same time, you cannot just take the same stack of technology, put it into a different context, and get the exact same result either. I think that's a really powerful and important idea.
Well, it's like when you go to cook something and, you know, there's various ingredients to make cookies. And, you know, is any one ingredient more important than the other? You know, maybe there is some that are slightly more important, and maybe there's some that you might could pull this piece out. Maybe if You had a really resourceful staff. You don't need like the fastest bandwidth to get out, and you can make it work, you know, doing what you have. But ultimately, all those pieces come together to create success. Just as all the ingredients in cookies come together to make a cookie, you've got to have the right technology. You've got to have the right infrastructure. You've got to have the right bandwidth. You've got to have the right staff. You've got to have the right support. All those things are pieces to the puzzle to make successful deployments and to ultimately create environments. You know, notice that this is one of my mantras that, you know, we don't use technology, you know, like as a substitute for what we do. You know, it's not like we're trying to like replace the teacher with an iPad. All those things are to work together to take the students, you know, further faster, basically. And so you want to use all those together to drive towards your goal, just in the same way businesses use technology in their organizations. Like their goals are ultimately the same, but technology changes their path and changes how they get there. You know, I'm working with a client right now on implementing some technology on how they handle maintenance at their various stores. And their goals are still the same, but they're trying to go faster, further, and be smarter by implementing, you know, certain technology. And again, the technology is important, but also your people that are using it, they're important. Then me that it's implementing is also important. All those things kind of have to work together. It's almost like they're all spinning around and we've got to connect up.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely, I believe that's right. And I think the way I've kind of been describing it to people is to say, look, the iPad or one-to-one technology is necessary, but not sufficient for radical change in your school. But I don't think in 2013 that you can put up with, you know, a low ratio of shared computers. I think that feels like the past now. But at the same time, just going one-to-one or just going iPad is not enough. But without some kind of dramatic increase in the accessibility of computers in the school, I think you then have to look at other things on top of that as well. So it's not about the technology, but it's also not all about the technology. I think that's really important. Okay, next thing, next chapter. Greenfield says the smart city pretends to an objectivity, a unity, and a perfect knowledge that are nowhere achievable even in principle. And in many ways, I feel like the idea of a fully networked learning analytics system is very much like that, that you can certainly capture some things into that system, but there's lots of things happening in school that you just can't represent in a database. And a lot of that's to do with the relationships between pupils and teachers and between other pupils together. But what he says here, let me just quote, he says, there's a logical positivism, which among other things implicitly holds that the world is in principle perfectly knowable, its contents innumerable, and the relations capable of being meaningfully encoded in the state of a technical system without bias or distortion. He also says that however many sensors are deployed, they'll only ever capture the qualities about the world that are amenable to capture. Measure only those qualities that can be measured. Let's stipulate for the moment that these mechanisms somehow operate flawlessly and in perpetuity. What if information crucial to the formulation of sound policy is somehow absent from their soundings, resides in the space between them, or is derived from the interaction between whatever quality of the world we set out to measure and our experience of it? Can you see immediately how there's a lot that goes on in school that would be missed by such a system?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Well, you know, I don't know if you ever watched the U.S. version of The Office show, and Michael Scott said one time somebody was complaining about a company being outdated, and his, you know, there's a lot in there, but his comment was that people never go out of style. People never go out of business. And I think often when you think about these systems, that to me, you're trying to take the people out of the equation. And you know, our headmaster always says when he's doing tours in the summer that you're really missing the best thing because our people are our best assets.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think in large part, as education has become more more of a process, more of a system, that the first thing that tried to take people out of the equation was the textbook. And a standardized textbook for every teacher in every classroom is the first guard against the variability in the quality of teachers. Now, a good teacher will take a textbook and turn it into a great lesson, but a poor teacher at least has a textbook. Whereas when you take the textbook away, you're very much depending purely on the professional abilities of the teacher. But I think if you think about something like, let's imagine an electronic reading scheme where the number of page turns are monitored. There are all kinds of things that you can imagine happening in a classroom that would cause the data to be that was gathered by that system to be completely bogus. You know, an interruption. It was a nice day, so we didn't do any reading that afternoon. We went outside instead. We went into the school grounds and we did something different. Why did this pupil sit on this one page for an hour? Well, the answer was that they actually went to lunch, but they left their iPad open at that page. And then you start to see all these weird anomalies of the data that you sort of lose because the teacher, what, you know, if an administrator is looking at that without the teacher being in the room or being as part of the analysis process, you start to lose some of that richness of experience and human information. I grabbed a quote from the Amplify tablet website just to kind of illustrate this. They say their headline is, "Go beyond merely capturing data with mobile technology designed to determine the next steps in instruction and content written to meet the demands of Common Core state standards." And I think in some ways that's kind of a very similar thing, is the idea that you capture data and then the system can automatically, without bias or confusion or without missing anything, can somehow automatically generate the next steps for a student. I find myself quite skeptical about that.
Well, yeah, I'm reminded when I was a senior in high school, I had this really great British Lit teacher. You know, British Lit, hey, you know. And we spent a week watching the old Star Wars movies, and he took us through the hero quest that all heroes go on at the top, and we would talk about it, and we would lecture. He would lecture about it. And I remember it to this day. And when I got into British Lit in college, I breezed through it because he was such a good teacher. And we specifically had a test on the hero quest. It was a long essay, and I did well. And so you look at that kind of learning doesn't fit in this system. We watched three movies, essentially. But I still remember it, largely, 11, 12 years later. And that's good teaching.
Yeah, so the question is, how do you represent inspiration in a database? Or how do you measure enthusiasm? How do you capture a student's interest? Is it just purely the number of pages they read? Does that equal interest? Or does it equal parental pressure? Who knows, right? So these purely database-driven models, I think, miss out a large part of the kind of joy of teaching, if you like. Next chapter I wanted to mention, I want to skip a chapter there and talk. He says that the smart city is overspecified. And I don't know if you've ever seen, Bradley, a school computer system that's overspecified, but what he says is overspecification is hubris and brittleness. It is to imply that the designer can anticipate at inception all the potential uses to which the things they create might be put down through the long future. And it's set in concrete relations that ought to remain supple and fluid. And this is something that's really hard right now. I find this really difficult to handle in school, is how much do we turn into a process and how much do we keep flexible and changeable as time goes by in school. And I think the way that Greenfield puts it later in the chapters, he says, in the end, the problem with over-specification is simply that it leads to a curiously static conception of the future. Once we get there, we stay there. So in many ways, when we build a computer system, once we implement that, we end up just doing that and nothing else. And in Scotland for many years, we've had a national intranet for schools called GLOW. And one of the things about GLOW was that it was specified basically in 2002 and took a number of years to be built and deployed to schools. And then by the time it was built and deployed, things had just been invented that hadn't been invented when the computer system was specified. And once that we got GLOW rolled out, people were already moving on to do newer things in the classroom, newer and newer things. And I think the more you specify as part of a cohesive large system that you build, the less you get to be flexible in the future. In some ways, doing less is actually doing more over the long term. Okay, next section. He talks about the idea that the smart city is predicated on a discredited notion of seamlessness. And what I mean by that is that, or what he means by it, is that when the user perceives no interruption in the flow of a technical experience, even though that experience might be produced by multiple different systems. So the idea that you have one interface to multiple different systems. And the point he makes is that when systems are designed to hide their complexity from the user, when those systems fail, it becomes difficult to recover from. And I think that's something that you and I have talked about before in the context of something like iCloud, where iCloud's supposed to be a seamless experience, but I think your experience and my experience has been that it hasn't been seamless. And because it is supposed to be seamless but isn't, then when it does fail in some elaborate way, like, for example, your mail client comes, starts up and is offline every time, how do you get inside that and debug it? Really hard.
Yeah, there's, you know, that we have this kind of vision of the future that's like the Jetsons or Minority Report, and we don't see firmware upgrades and everything just works. And, you know, I was laying in bed last night, and I've mentioned before that we have a Nest thermostat, and we absolutely love it. And it's, I was guaranteed it's saving me money. But what it does is, like, it, various times it will go to sleep to recharge its rechargeable battery that it has on the inside. And it seems like it does this kind of late at night. So my wife and I were going to bed last night, and she opened up the app, and the Nest was disconnected. So it disconnected 7 minutes ago. And so, like, obviously it was charging. So it's like, you know, for all the seamlessness of the Nest, it's not perfect. And when you create this vision of the future that is perfect, that, you know, that is in the movies, that everything just works all the time, then you largely are going to leave people disappointed.
Yep. I mean, that's such a big issue in schools as well, particularly when Adam Greenfield quotes a British author called James Bridle. And James Bridle says, "Those who cannot perceive the network cannot act effectively within it and are essentially powerless." I think the point he's kind of making there is that if you can't understand, make a mental model of what's happening to you or what's happening with your data, then you're sort of powerless in the face of the people who do. And I think the classic example for me of that is Facebook. The reason I've never really used Facebook in any enthusiastic manner, apart from signing up and disabling it a couple of times, is that I was incapable of forming a mental model of what the Facebook network looked like. Now, Twitter's simple. To my mind, Twitter's simple. I follow a bunch of people, I see their tweets, and if they follow me, they see my tweets. That's Twitter. Whereas Facebook has multiple different parts to the moving system. And if you don't know where that data is going to end up, you are sort of powerless in the face of people who actually do have control over that data. And I think in some ways, the learning systems can be a little bit like that as well. The student thinks they're just turning a page in a book, but in fact, they're making a record in a database. They're being analyzed by that, but they can't tell that, partly because they may be very young, or maybe they just don't care to know, or maybe they don't put two and two together and see that that's what's happening. But in fact, those actions become formalized and they become recorded and they become amenable to analysis in the future. And I think that's something to be concerned about. There's privacy implications, obviously, at levels of things like Facebook and cities. But there's also just, you know, if I knew you were watching me, I would have done it differently. And I think that's something to be aware of when looking at smart classroom types of technology. One I really wanted to jump on, Bradley, as well, was the idea that, and this was the one that actually caught my attention, as, well, that sounds a lot like school. He says that the smart city systems are deployed for the sole benefit of administrators. And to me, this is kind of one of the most damning things about smart classroom technology, is that it's not really, it's certainly not about learners. It's only barely about teachers. And what it's really about are school administrators. So if you look at a lot of the smart classroom literature, what it's really about is it's about helping school managers get big data reports about what percentage of their pupils are at this level or that level, or, you know, how many people are being intervened on, how many people have got records of additional support needs and so on and so on. And my question always is, well, how does that help the learner? Does it help the learner? What does a learner care if you've got a report about this or that or the next thing? And how does it enhance their experience of school to be monitored by a reading support program. Maybe it does in some cases. Maybe it stops kids dropping through the cracks. I'm not saying there's no benefit to it, but my reading of a lot of the literature around it is that the people designing these systems are not really thinking what's the best possible thing for the student. That's my feeling about it anyway.
Well, and you think about when people are building these, who are their customers? It's not the students. It's school administrators. So they build their packages and applications and tools built around making the school administrator's life easy and giving them data to use. It's not, you know, it's not always built around what, you know, the student is my customer. You know, I joked with somebody yesterday. They were saying, you know, hey, when can you come by to help me? I said, you tell me when to come by. I work for you. And they said, no, you don't. I said, no, I work for you. I mean, your happiness is my happiness. And I think there is that disconnect that most of the tools out there, you know, a tool that detects how long a student stays on a page, you know, you're right. I guess it could be used in some ways, but is that the intended use of it? I mean, that seems like that's more for control.
Yeah. And one of the things that Adam Greenfield goes on to talk about is he says that many of the smart city technologies or the potential of the smart city is consistent with the exercise of authoritarianism. And that's obviously a political statement about the structure of urban democracy, if you like. But if you think about it, school's quite an authoritarian place to be, right? Most of the people in a school are compelled by law to be there. They're not allowed to leave. And they have to do what another group of people tells them to do. Schools have been compared to prisons in the past. not only by the students, but sometimes by the teachers as well, I think. But I think that in many ways in our society, what's happening right now is that traditional hierarchical power structures are being challenged by digital technologies. They're being challenged by the networked group of people who are maybe geographically disparate or something like that, or maybe just economically disparate. But what a lot of these smart classroom technologies do is they sort of exist and they purport to reinforce the existing power structure. So if you look at the Amplify tablet, for example, a lot of the rhetoric around Amplify is about reinforcing teacher and administrator control in the system. So for example, they have this feature called Eyes on Teacher, where there's like a big Frankenstein style kill switch that teachers can throw, and suddenly every tablet in the room is locked out, and then the teacher has control of everybody. So it's almost like, you know, getting everybody's attention in one go with a big switch. So it's interesting to me to compare that, Bradley, to the experience in Los Angeles that we talked about a few weeks ago, where in some ways, the fact that Apple has a very user-centric design model for iOS, that was what enabled that quote-unquote rebellion in the ranks of the students in LA, was the fact that Apple's system was not actually as locked down for administrators as you could build, say, an Android-based tablet like Amplify. And then at that level, even though, ironically, because the system is open source, you can build more locks into that system than you can on the closed source iOS system, because Apple simply has ethos that you're not allowed to do that. Does that make sense? Am I explaining that correctly?
No, you are. Yeah, absolutely. The user is king allowed that to happen, and it's the very design of it that allowed it to happen. And it is ironic that you could control it more with an open source, you know, software application.
So I guess my question is, you know, to what extent do you want the school to be enabling of pupils versus what extent do you want to kind of have the pupil just sit there and, you know, be part of a system that is controlled remotely? And that's a really philosophical question. I don't know if I have the answer to that right now, but I certainly think that I know where I kind of, where my bias lies, which is towards enabling the student to do more and create more and express themselves more, express their learning. And it's not just about controlling people's steps through a predetermined set of lesson plans or a predetermined set of learning pathways, even if those pathways appear to be personalized but when they're personalized, like by an algorithm or just by pure data, as we talked about earlier, it's not clear to me that that data can ever be rich enough to really give students what they absolutely need at a certain time and a certain place.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, so much about it's, let's say a student is behind in English or even overall, so much about their lives could be influencing that. It may have nothing to do with data you gather in the classroom, but yet their parents are going through a divorce and that's why they're struggling. You know, that your data programs are never going to tell you that. It's where you have to get to know the student and understand what their issues are.
Yeah. I mean, where do you represent in a database that today this person fell out with their friends? Or they tripped over in the playground and hurt their arm? Or they injured their wrist or whatever? And they couldn't do as much that afternoon as any other afternoon. You know, that's the real life of teaching. That's the real business of school. And to just depend on a database for all the formulation of that, I think misses the point in a big way. So, we're getting towards the end here. I think maybe let's just wrap this up, right? Is that the thing that Greenfield ends with, and I want to end with this as well, Bradley, is to say that he says that the same set of technical potentials that give rise to the smart city can be turned to more responsive ends. And I think that's the point we were just making, is that the technology that enables you to quantify and measure and use data only as the driver of the educational experience, whether that be just seeing who's behind and who's not behind, or whether that's actually using a computer to algorithmically generate the next steps and the next lessons that a student needs to take, I think that is just... I feel like I don't even have the language to express what I think about it, but you can just do so much more. Like, if you're buying a computer for every student in the classroom, to just use that as a tool of control and measurement for what the student does next, what lesson the student sits through next on their tablet, is such a tiny fraction of everything you could be doing with that amount of technology, that I just feel it is very, very... it's a small vision. Even though it's a big cost and a big step for many schools to adopt that, I think there's just so much more empowerment that you could do if you just weren't so focused on the database aspect of the whole thing.
I agree.
So that's why I think what we'll do is we'll put a link to the Kindle single in the show notes as well, just so that people can find this little book. I think it's very interesting. If you read it, I mean, it's interesting from its own point of view as well. I think it's what he's writing about in terms of our cities and our data is very, very important, particularly these days. But if you read it with the lens of educational technology on top of it, I don't think it's too much of a stretch to read some of that and say, yeah, I feel like some of the similar principles are being applied to certain computer systems that are being sold to schools and some that are certainly being deployed as well. And we've mentioned Amplify as one example, and I think it's perhaps just the most current and perhaps the best known example of these kind of systems, but there are others too. This is also not to say that every single educational technology system that includes a database is necessarily authoritarian, evil, and all these kind of things. That's not the point I'm trying to make here, but I'm just trying to say that there are different philosophies that go behind this as well. And we don't talk about philosophy that much on this show. I mean, we talk about the technology and we talk about the deployment tools and all that kind of stuff. But I think, you know, more and more, Brad, and I know you get these emails as well. I get emails from people who say, we've just bought a whole bunch of iPads. We've deployed them to kids and staff. Do you have any tips for how to make this a success? Have you? I don't know if you've ever had an email like that, Bradley.
Every week.
Yeah, me too. And I think the thing I've started to write back to these people is I've asked them, well, what's your educational philosophy for technology in the classroom? And quite often I don't get any other emails after that, so it's quite an effective way to write back to them. But I think the point is that the point Greenfield made halfway through what we talked about here was the idea that just because I've got a stack of iPads and you've got a stack of iPads doesn't mean that we are going to behave the same way with them. We're not necessarily going to deploy them in the same way or act around them in the same way. And there's so much more that you have to unpack from that question beyond just, you've got iPads, I've got iPads, let's share ideas. but it's, you know, what do you want to achieve with the computer? How are you deploying it? Are you gathering data? Are you not gathering data? What else are you doing with it? That you've got to start to unpack a lot of that before you can even begin to answer the question. And in some ways, I wish these people would email me 6 months before they buy anything, not 3 weeks after, looking for tips and tricks.
No, there's more than having a free credit line to making this stuff work.
Yeah.
It's not just about the money. Sure. It's about the people. It's about the plan. It's about the goals.
And you can't just, you know, throw it in there and expect it all to work technologically or educationally.
Well, and we don't do that with anything else in the classroom. Just, you know, we don't do the shotgun approach and throw a bunch of stuff and see what sticks. We have a plan for everything else.
Yeah.
You know, you have your lesson plans. You have your, what you need the kids to learn by the end of school. And you have a plan and you attack it. And that's how everything should be, technology included.
And I think in some ways as well, that you have to be aware of the kind of scale of what it is you're doing. That if you are going to introduce computers in a big way into school, then that's going to have effects and it's going to have ripples that reach out into many, many other areas of both behavior and organizational management. And really, you know, follow the path along. What happens when pupils are doing most of their schoolwork on a computer and then they've got to write a paper-based exam, you know, 3 years down the line or whatever? You've got to think about all of those things as well. It's like, you know, what happens in a city when everybody's, you know, being driven around in self-driving cars inside the city and then they go to another country where they don't have that? What, do they just all get run over by accident because they don't know how to be safe? It's like a British person going to America and the cars are all on the wrong side of the road. It's fine for the first day, and then the second day you think you've got a handle on it, and then you go into a car park or something and suddenly you forget that you should have been thinking about it, and then you get run over. I'm not saying that's happened to me. I've never been run over, but I have on occasion stepped out in front of some very large American cars by mistake. It's happened.
Yeah, we'll forgive you this time.
Okay. Shall we wrap it up there, Bradley?
Yeah, I think so.
This has been a highly experimental podcast. I don't know that we got our ideas across exactly, but I think if people take what we've talked about here and go ahead and read that book, I think it's going to be a very interesting read. And I hope it'll keep you going until the iPad comes out.
Less than $10 on the Kindle store as well.
Yeah. So it's a good read, and it's a quick read as well. So I think we'll leave it there. Obviously, next week, Bradley, we're going to try and catch up after the iPad announcement.
Yes.
See whatever Apple comes out with. They finally sent out their invitations, I think, late last night.
Yes.
And the phrase is what? We've got a lot more to cover. So, of course, the rampant speculation is there's going to be a keyboard cover in the most literal possible translations of the tea leaves that Apple have laid down. But we'll see what they have to say about new iPads. Presumably new iPad Mini as well, and possibly things like Mavericks and Mac Pros.
We shall see.
We shall see. We can only wait and see. All right, Bradley. We'll talk again next week.
All right. Have a good week.
Okay, you too.